This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Islam rose again after this period. Didn't have science associated with it. No new inventions in math. You look at the period of Islam in Spain, the period where the great Alhambra was built. There is no attendant science going on there. It's done. It's gone.
This is now going to be in the public sphere for people to ridicule you and to remind you of your incompetence. Every time they see your face, they'll be reminded of your academic incompetence on these fields. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. How are you guys doing? So I came across a clip by a new atheist academic called Neil deGrasse. Now, this individual is put forward in a lot of the kind of debates and public discussions, and he gets millions of views, and he represents the kind of new atheism from as much as I can understand from his polemics. And really, when I watched this clip, I thought to myself, should I dignify these comments with a response? And I, at the end of it, I said I have to, because this is such a ridiculous showing of academic incompetence that I thought it must be answered. So let's take a look at this clip and dissect it piece by piece.
At this point, Islam is maybe just a few hundred years old.
So the first thing he says Islam is just a few hundred years old. Now, I don't know how he defines a few, but at the time of Al-Ghazali, Islam is around 500 years, which is half a millennium. So this is already showing you precursors to the bigger errors that are going to come.
People are reading the Quran and interpreting it however they sort of want to and feel like it. There's not a coherence to the practice of Islam until he comes around.
He says something here which I don't understand what he means by, because he says before Ghazali there was no coherence to the practice of Islam. Now, I don't understand what he means by this, because from a jurisprudential perspective, the four a'imma, or the four imams, major imams of Sunni Islam, and by the way, also the major branch of Shi'i Islam, were all established. I mean, you had, the four madhahib. You had usul fiqh being established by the book of al-Shafi'i, who wrote al-Risala, one of the most early commentaries or explications of usul fiqh, or the principles of jurisprudence. You had the codification of all of the major hadith books, including Bukhari and Muslim and so on. So I don't really understand what he means by the fact that there was no coherence to the practice of Islam, especially because Al-Ghazali himself was positioned, or was from the school of thought of the Shafi'is, and he was from the school of thought, from an Aqidah perspective, of the Ash'aris. So he was part of the discourse, but he was not in any way, making his own school of thought. I mean, there were practices that were already codified from a jurisprudential, creedal, and hadith perspective. So I didn't understand really what he meant by this, but let's go on and see what he says next.
People are reading the Quran and interpreting it however they sort of want to and feel like it. There's not a coherence to the practice of Islam until he comes around.
Now, he says that Muslims were interpreting the Quran in whatever way they wanted to. But this is false, because there were principles of istinbat, as is mentioned in the Quran. You know, لَعَلِمَهُ الَّذِينَ يَسْتَنْبِطُونَهُ مِنْهُمْ, as the Quran says, that those who are able to do extrapolation would be able to do so. And this extrapolation is a method, right? So it's called, tafsir method, or the exegetical method. This was already laid down well before, you know, Al-Ghazali. Al-Tabari had his magnum opus, or his compendious or voluminous or encyclopedic tafsir, and this was well known, and many other tafsir or exegetical works were made thereafter. So this idea that people were haphazardly, you know, interpreting the Quran in the way that they wanted to is far from the theological truth, and this shows that this man is weak academically in his presentation.
And codifies the behavior of a good Muslim. In much the same way St. Augustine, in his book Cities of God, codified what it is to be a good Christian.
And he says that Augustine codified what it is to be a good Christian, as if he was, you know, in the 5th century as he came along, he was the one who did so, and there was not a patristic backdrop to his existence. I mean, many of the church fathers predated Augustine by hundreds of years. I mean, you have Justin Martyr, you have Origen of Alexandria, you have all of these big names, and you have the so-called ecumenical councils, Chalcedon and Nicaea and all of these things. I mean, was there not a Christian community before Augustine came along? This shows you that his patristic understanding or understanding of patristic scholarship is as weak or even probably weaker than his historical knowledge and or theological knowledge as it relates to Islam. So let's go on.
The assertion that the manipulation of numbers is the work of the devil.
All right, so here he makes his big claim. He says that Al-Ghazali mentions that it's the manipulation of numbers are the work of the devil. Assuming or presupposing that Al-Ghazali, of all people he could have chosen, and this is ridiculous, because Al-Ghazali, of all the, for anyone who knows just a little bit of either the philosophy of religion or intellectual history, they would know who Al-Ghazali is. For all the people in the Islamic world you've decided to choose, you chose Al-Ghazali to say that he was against science and mathematics. And what's worse is that the quote that he mentioned is nowhere to be found in his compendious works. The closest thing I found was something in his Ihya Ulum al-Din, which is a book, it's a huge book, made many volumes, voluminous. And in his Kitab al-Ilm, he mentions that people who go far in excesses when it comes to not just mathematics, but in other fields, in kalam and otherwise, that they would be damaging themselves. But he actually mentions in the same book, by the way, this book is translated into English. And you can pick up an English translation by Kenneth Honnekamp. And you'll find in page 38 that Al-Ghazali says the opposite of what you're saying that he said. Al-Ghazali mentions that it's fard kifaya, that it's a communal obligation for people to learn the praised sciences, as he calls them, of medicine and of mathematics. You see, this is the distortion that the new atheists have to resort to in order to try and attack religious narratives. Absolute distortions, and they should be ashamed of themselves that they're coming forward and speaking in this way without the academic competence. The academic competence of checking their work. I mean, if this was done in another context with other fields, they would be all over us and attacking us. But this is historical information which has been distorted. And how dare you mention Al-Ghazali of all the scholars you could have mentioned? An individual who had a method which was systematic. And if you really look at René Descartes, who was the father of rationalism in the West, and his book, The Meditations, where he went through systematic doubt in order to come to cogito ergo sum, which is I think, therefore I am. You'll realize that in Al-Munqidh Min Al-Dalal and the books of Tahafat Al-Falasifa and all of those books, that the same method of systematic doubt, well before René Descartes came along with it, was exhibited and presented by the works of Al-Ghazali, where he done exactly the same thing, a systematic doubt, a skeptical approach, and then the kalam method and the arguments from kalam, which are all over the academic world now, popularized by the likes of William Lane Craig and others in atheist discussions, were taken from Al-Ghazali. Why, if he is somebody who is averse to the logical process or averse to mathematics or averse to medicine and science. In his book, Al-Mustasfa, which is one of the most elaborative books on the topic of the principles of jurisprudence, he starts this book with a discussion on epistemology. And he started a tradition of doing that, such that even Hanabila, who were more conservative and reserved, especially when it came to kalam, the systematic theology, someone like Ibn Qudama, in his book, in his Usul book, which was really a copy or of a template of Al-Ghazali, he also did the same thing in the first manuscript that you find. So he started a tradition of a discussion about epistemology and about these philosophical matters. How dare you attribute to him, of all people in the Muslim world, that he was averse to and against science, mathematics, and technology. You should be ashamed of yourself. And this is, you should come out and apologize. You should come out and apologize to the Muslim community and to the academic community, not just the Muslim, to the academic community for distorting the intellectual history of the medieval period in such a way. You should come out and apologize. I want to see an apology on your Twitter or whatever it is you use. Yes. Because how dare you come out and lie flagrantly, blatantly, and obviously lie about something which you didn't have the common decency to double check. You make me sick. You make me sick. And this is what the new atheist movement has to resort to. Flagrant and obvious lies in order to distort the public narrative and to try and bring people away from religion. You have failed and you should be ashamed of yourself.
Two, actions that you see in nature are the will of Allah. Well, if you drop a stone and it falls, Allah willed that.
He's talking about philosophy. And then he makes a bigger blunder. He says, you see, all the actions are from the will of Allah. And here he's referring to occasionalism. Occasionalism, which is an Ash'ari doctrine. And by the way, Al-Ghazali, if you really read his books, he didn't believe in it in as much the same way as many of his predecessors did. As many of the scholars, even in the West now, have spoken about. He believed in a second order causation. But anyway, this is aside the point. You wouldn't even understand what I'm talking about. What is important here? Because you're a fool, with all due respect, and you're ignorant of these things. So I'm going to speak and you're not going to understand. But what you should know is, what's really funny and ironic is, people that you have had interviews with on this topic of determinism and free will, like Sam Harris, who wrote a book called Free Will, believe in determinism. And so they don't believe. So you're saying here the will of God. So this stops curiosity and stops our kind of motivation or disincentivize us from doing things.
If that's your explanation, your curiosity stops.
But a determinist, even if they're an atheist who believes in an uninterrupted causal chain, will have exactly the same philosophical baggage. So when you are seated in front of your friend, Sam Harris, who wrote a book called Free Will, and he wrote at the bottom of it, Sam Harris, but actually he shouldn't have put his name there, because it wasn't Sam Harris with his free will that wrote that book, but it was a set of determined, uninterrupted caused events that wrote that book. You should have inquired about that. About why could it be the case that a deterministic worldview will interrupt someone's incentive to do things, because otherwise everyone's a puppet, everyone's doing things without free will. So if you're arguing that this disincentivizes people from, or makes them less curious from doing things like science, then this argument can be made on the worldview of determinism. You see, you've shot yourself in the foot because of your lack of knowledge, not just in theology and history, but also in philosophy, the philosophy of religion and other than that. So you should be ashamed of yourself once again, and you're embarrassing yourself. You are absolutely embarrassing yourself. The more you talk, the more you make blunders. And you're getting caught out. And no longer is the Muslim community or even any religious community going to sit idly by watching individuals like you talk rubbish and make mistakes and blunders and just leave you to do what you want to do. And maybe some of our youth will listen to what you have to say and be convinced. No, we're going to hold you to account, to academic account. Not just on a peer-reviewed journal that only a few elites can look at. No, this is now going to be in the public sphere for people to ridicule you and to remind you of your incompetence. Every time they see your face, they'll be reminded of your academic incompetence on these fields.
Islam rose again after this period. Didn't have science associated with it.
And look at this claim that he makes. He says, Islam rose again after this period. But it didn't have science. Oh my God. Now you've humiliated yourself. With all due respect to you, that you don't actually deserve, you've humiliated yourself. How have you humiliated yourself? You've humiliated yourself. Completely humiliated yourself. So let me give you a few names. Ibn Nafis. When did he die? Ibn Nafis, one of the greatest figures of the medieval period and in the Arab world, in the Islamic period. 1213. This is how many years after Al-Ghazali died? Maybe about 200 years. In fact, exactly 202 years. Yes? Or 102 years. So what? Ibn Nafis was not... he was brainwashed by Al-Ghazali. Somehow, the works of Al-Ghazali stopped everyone from doing science. Does this even sound rational to you? I mean, your irrationality, your new atheist irrationality is so limited that you can't even understand. Oh, one book, is it really going to change the way everyone operates in the entire Islamicate period? Ibn Nafis, when did he die? I mean, didn't you even want to dignify yourself by checking these things up? I mean, some of the contemporaries of Al-Ghazali were doing mathematics. Umar Khayyam. He died like a couple of dozen years after. He died some years after Al-Ghazali. I mean, oh, he was a mathematician. Oh, why didn't he stop doing maths? I mean, this is ridiculous. Al-Adrisi. What about Al-Adrisi, the geographer? Wait a minute. What about At-Tusi? At-Tusi, who Copernicus references. Yes, he references in his book. And obviously Copernicus, you know, is the figurehead of the scientific revolution in the 16th century.
And though Al-Battani is the only Islamic astronomer Copernicus actually names, recent detective work has uncovered clues that Copernicus based many of his ideas on the work of other Islamic scholars. The clearest example is Copernicus's use of a mathematical idea devised by the 13th century Islamic astronomer Al-Tusi.
You have never read the works of Copernicus, because if you did, you'd know it's not just At-Tusi that he references, but he also references Ali Qusji. Now, Ali Qusji was an Ottoman into the 15th or 16th century, well after Al-Ghazali. He was an Ottoman, but he was instrumental. He was absolutely instrumental in influencing the Copernican revolution, or the scientific revolution, which is probably the biggest paradigm shift, to use the term of Thomas Kuhn, that the Western world has ever had in terms of scientific enterprise. Only to be compared possibly with the movement from Newtonian to Einsteinian physics. How dare you stand in front of people and teach them false information? How dare you do that? How dare you stand there and say the things that you've said without even having the dignity and the self-respect of checking those things out? And look what he says after that. He says, there's 1.3 billion Muslims. Let's take a look. He says, there's 1.3 billion Muslims, and how many Muslims won the Nobel Prize? And he says, he calls this the best measure.
There is 1.3 billion Muslims in the world today who are not participants on the frontier of scientific discovery. What's the best measure of this? Just check out the Nobel Prizes. I tallied them, okay? How many Jews have won the Nobel Prize? In the sciences, here they go.
The best measure. Wait a minute. So the argument here is that something inherently in Islam, because of Al-Ghazali, so in other words, every Muslim now is influenced by Al-Ghazali's thought, even the Shi'is, or even the Hanabila, who are not influenced by him, or other madhahib, or other people. Everyone's influenced by Al-Ghazali, and Al-Ghazali has influenced them to drop science and technology and mathematics. And so everyone, because they needed Al-Ghazali to tell them that, everyone dropped science and technology, even though Samarkand, which had one of the biggest and most influential observatories of the Muslim world, was actually established some centuries after Al-Ghazali's death. I'm shocked as a physicist that you don't know about the history of physics. You're an ignorant person. And now you're making the claim that of a 1.3 billion, actually this must be an old statistic, because there's way more than 1.3 billion according to Pew, another mistake. 8 billion, let's say, Muslims in the world. And he says, look how many people won Nobel Prizes. Well, okay, let me ask you a question. How many black people have won Nobel Prizes? Let me ask you a question. How many black people? Now, if I say that to you and you say, well, that's because of poverty and slavery and all of those things and colonialism. Okay, all of those excuses can be afforded to the Muslim world. Much of which have been colonized, especially after the Ottoman fall. So disenfranchisement and poverty and all those things. And you can make the same excuses. And then he compares us with Jewish people, which is a false comparison. I don't know why he does that, because obviously. And the Nobel Prize, I mean, let's be honest. The Nobel Prize, and this just shows me how much of an Uncle Tom you are, with all due respect. Yes, because you respect the white man so much that when the white man and his institutions, they decide who wins the Nobel Prize, because it's obviously ideologically linked, right? It's to the Western post-Enlightenment experience. They decide who wins Nobel Prizes. You think that's somehow a measure of objective scientific discovery and enterprise and so on? And that's why you could never, ever debate a Muslim who knows just a little bit of Islam and a little bit of history. You would never step forward and put yourself, your neck on the academic chopping board, because you know what would happen. What would happen is the people would see an intellectual decapitation. So you roll back into the hole that you came from, and if you don't offer the apology, then you got to live with the humiliation. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.